Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy and Dr. Scott Gottlieb, former FDA commissioner for time under President Trump. Over the weekend on CNBC, had this to say about the L.A. County mask mandate redux that's been reinstituted.
I don't think it's the right move. I don't think you can tell people who've been vaccinated that they have to wear a mask. I think, quite frankly, it's likely to be the exception. I think you're likely to see very few states and municipalities do this because there's not going to be a lot of support for mandates at this point. People who are worried about COVID have largely been vaccinated. I realize not everyone has been able to get vaccinated, but most people have been vaccinated who are worried about this infection. And people who remain unvaccinated aren't worried about the infection and don't want to be wearing masks either. Now, the bottom line is that means this is just going to spread through the population. And that's why the models look so bad. There's some models being worked on right now. CDC has one, I'm told, that show an increasing epidemic, a wave of infection from this Delta variant moving through the population over the next 2 months. Those models, the assumptions built into those models is no mitigation. No mandates for masks, no closures of businesses. I think that's likely to be the norm. And also, you know, when you get vaccinated, you're less likely to spread the infection, less likely to contract the infection. So people who are vaccinated aren't putting the population, by and large, at risk. So telling them that they have to wear masks indoors, I think it creates a disincentive to go out and get vaccinated in the first place.
Well, perhaps, but those sort of contradictions are no hurdle to the Democrats, Democrat socialists, the lockdowners, the COVIDians, the enthusiasts in your life and times that you see around in your schools and your mayor's offices and your governor's mansions and so forth.
And at church and everywhere. I call them the poly spot lovers. They don't want to give up the mask. They don't want to give up COVID. They don't know how to function without it.
But the larger issue over the weekend, it was not the reintroduction of mask mandates. I suspect Dr. Gottlieb is right that these are not going to be the norm. They're not going to be reinstituted across the board. Most will be reticent to go where L.A. County has now gone. But we'll see how much hysteria is whipped up in the response to the Delta variant, which was what dominated the Sunday talkies. And again, here, the idea of CDC models look dire, and this is going to be a pandemic for the unvaccinated. It's now the endemic because of the unvaccinated and so on and so forth. Well, I mean, I just sort of a baseline here to not accept the hysteria at face value. I hope we've learned that by now. The doom and gloom at face value, the models at face value. I mean, I go back to a June op-ed, so just a little over a month ago, from Dr. Marty Makary over at Johns Hopkins, who you've heard on our program many times. He writes, the news about the COVID pandemic is even better than you've heard. Some 80 to 85% of American adults are immune to the virus. More than 64% have received at least one vaccine dose, and of those who haven't, roughly half have natural immunity from prior infection. There is ample evidence that natural immunity is effective and durable, and public health leaders should pay it heed, although they won't, and it wasn't discussed at all.
But that's what Senator Paul's been saying all along, natural immunity, that is left out of this conversation, because he has that, because he had COVID.
The other thing that's left out of the conversation is that the efficacy of one jab when it comes to COVID prevention, one jab of one of the vaccines. I mean, yes, two jabs have the much advertised 90 to 95% efficacy rate. But the argument that was made for the first jab first for the last 4 months, 5 months by many public health professionals, economists and others, is that it doesn't mean that the first jab provides no level of immunity. It just doesn't get to the 95% level.
Right. And my doctor told me it's 70%. And now they're coming out and saying, well, no, but against the Delta variant, Dan, now they're saying it's only 30% effective.
Well, there's some research out of Israel that suggests that the mRNA vaccines are not as effective against the Delta variant as they are against the underlying novel coronavirus 19. Okay. Well, this still calls into question just exactly what is the threat level. What is it exactly you're saying? That the next round of infections come this fall will be children 12 and under who have shown remarkable immunity to steadfastness in the face of COVID infections to the extent they get infected at all?
Yeah,
is there any evidence to support that there's this cohort of people, the unvaccinated or the young, that is susceptible, so susceptible to the Delta variant that you're going to see something unique in terms of hospitalizations and death that you didn't see during COVID-19, meaning you have vulnerable populations, 70 plus and comorbidities, and then you sort of have everybody else.
Some states had zero cases and they jumped to one. So then the mainstream media says cases have doubled. Well, yeah, when you had zero, now you have one. Yeah, your cases have doubled. And why would anybody trust government officials after they told us this? Get the vaccine. You'll take your mask off.
If they are vaccinated and they are not wearing a mask, they are safe.
If they've been vaccinated, obviously, according to public health guidance, they don't need to wear a mask.
Let me emphasize that if you are vaccinated, you have a very high degree of protection, and therefore you do not need to wear a mask.
Yeah, but that is going to be the norm. That is the norm. L.A. County is an outlier right now.
Well, and Vegas is thinking about doing it, too.
Vaccinated and not wearing a mask is the norm. What have we spent the last week talking about? A COVID apartheid. If you're unvaccinated, then Kathleen Sebelius doesn't think you should be able to see your children or go to work. Vaccinated versus unvaccinated. The entire discussion on the weekend talk shows was just driving vaccination, vaccination, vaccination. And anybody who has any questions, that's misinformation and you need to be banned from all social media platforms. That was the discussion this weekend. And speaking of which, we'll pick it up there to talk about doubling down on Dr. Murthy's ministry of truth over the weekend as well. Okay, we'll go to Craig in Mount Greenwood. You're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
All right, Dan, Amy, thank you for taking the call. It's all bullcrap. Whatever happened to the regular flu, Delta, if you're not vaccinated, they don't want to give up the power. They just don't want to give up power. That's it. It's all bullcrap.
Craig, have you been vaccinated?
Well.
Okay.
All right. Tell you what I tell everybody. Because of hip and everything, not going to answer your question.
Okay. All right. But you got, okay, HIPAA notwithstanding, you're waiving your HIPAA privileges. You got vaccinated because it just made sense, right?
Oh, yeah. It's the thing to do. I tell people who make that leap, why don't you go get a shot and then you don't have to worry about me?
Okay.
You got a great, thanks.
All right. Thanks, Craig.
Craig. And you haven't been vaccinated. Or do you not want to talk about that?
Do you have a point?
No. I'm saying, why haven't you gotten vaccinated?
Because I don't feel the need to.
Okay. I got a great text message in. I'm trying to be optimistic, Amy, but I can't help but feel that something has shifted in the last 48 hours. I keep hoping that our leaders will finally have the courage to acknowledge that it is simply unsustainable to have all elements of life aimed at suppressing this virus. They're testing healthy people still at the Olympics and the New York Yankees. And next, you know what's going to happen. They're going to start testing healthy children at school. And then we're going to be in quarantine all over again.
Well, one of the things that is worthy of discussion is whether you should be testing people for the antibodies before they were administered the vaccine. I mean, this is a whole nother aspect of the conversation. There are many nuances. Should you, if you were infected and recover, be vaccinated? There's a lot of evidence to suggest that that vaccination is as durable, if not more so, than the mRNA vaccines. But again, any sorts of questions like this, anything that is not reduced to the binary, You're vaccinated, you're not vaccinated. You're wearing a mask, you're not wearing a mask. You're social distancing, you're not social distancing. Everything's just a binary. And you think that the science and the dynamics of living in the real world are that simple ever? Of course they're not. So why would you trust people that treat you like an infant and boil everything down to do this good, do that bad, there's nothing in between. And no questions will be entertained. We've come to our conclusions. This is the received wisdom that we're sharing with you. Now follow orders. This isn't what Dr. Murthy says, which is what we're going to get to at 538. This isn't Dr. Murthy's, if you're not sure, don't say anything. This is, if you're not agreeing with us, then shut up. Euphemistically, he's saying exactly what I've just said. Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. One of the great lines in First Amendment jurisprudence comes from Justice Robert Jackson's majority opinion in the 1943 case West Virginia v. Barnett, which was a salute the flag, the recite the pledge case. First Amendment does not compel students to salute the flag and say the pledge. One of the great lines. Compulsory unification of opinion achieves only the unanimity of the graveyard. And you've heard me say that reference that line in the show before, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
And it seemed to be referencing it more and more with each passing day in 2020 America because it's so relevant today. It's so prescient. It's Orwellian almost in its relevance. Compulsory unification of opinion achieves only the unanimity of the graveyard. You see that, by the way, being rebelled against in Cuba right now, the compulsory unification of opinion. And so the questions over the weekend after the Ministry of Truth was rolled out by Surgeon General Vivek Murthy and Jen Psaki last week, Dr. Murthy and his Ministry of Truth on with Dana Bash on CNN, to answer the question, is Fox News and our other conservative outlets killing people?
Dan?
President Biden did accuse social media platforms of killing people. Do you think conservative media like Fox News are doing the same? Are they killing people too with rhetoric like you just heard?
Well, Dan, I think all of us, including the media, including individuals, health professionals, have a responsibility to share the truth about health as science dictates, as science informs us. And, you know, unless we do that, unless we are honest about the consequences of our communication with people, unless we are rigorous about ensuring that what we communicate is actually sourced from science and not from opinion on critical issues like the vaccine, then we are going to ultimately put people at risk. And that is my great worry, Dana. There are people all across our country, and I hear from folks all the time, who are struggling to make decisions about their health. After this very difficult year we've been through, people deserve to have access to accurate information. They deserve to hear that from their leaders. Oh my God. They deserve to hear that from the media. They deserve to see that on platforms online. And that they need that information to be able to make decisions to protect themselves and their families. That's the least we can do for them. And my worry is that all this is misinformation that's floating around. It's having a real cost that can be measured in lives lost, and that is just tragic.
That's a long way of saying, yes, they are killing people. You know, it's...
Facebook's killing people. Fox News is killing people.
You have to have metaphysical certainty in order to offer a viewpoint. Is that the new standard?
Well, they don't want to hear opposing opinions.
So, doctor, man of science, as you are, how do people in the scientific community hazard a hypothesis that needs to be tested? What's a hypothesis? It's an educated guess.
Right.
That's why we have the scientific method to challenge it and see that if it holds up under scrutiny and challenge. So you're telling me you cannot share anything that may be deemed misinformation by who? Dr. Murthy's Ministry of Truth? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. All this social media, and by the way, this recalls when we had the discussions about banning Facebook Live and so on and so forth because of people using Facebook Live to broadcast acts of violence,
right,
and so
murders.
On.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Social media is the enemy. Social media is killing people. Media is killing people.
Facebook is killing people.
Well, that would be social media.
Yeah. And Joe Biden doubled down on it. Excuse me, President Biden.
What's your message to platforms like Facebook?
They're killing people. I mean, they're really... Look, the only pandemic we have is among the unvaccinated. And they're killing people.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA and then a quick comment.
And I think I argued at the time against those who wanted to ban Facebook Live.
That was me.
Yeah, but like you, which is, what is Facebook Live? What is Facebook? It's a communication channel.
And then I used Facebook Live.
So if you don't like the fact that social media is an intellectual sewer, then don't blame the communication channel. Blame the content providers. That would be you, me, and everybody else.
Right. Well, Facebook fought back. They said we're not going to be distracted by accusations which aren't supported by the facts. And they pointed out that more than 3.3 million Americans have used their vaccine finder tool to find out where and how to get vaccinated.
Yeah, it's a marketplace of ideas and content. And so you're going to get a mixed bag, aren't you? So... do we want to be in the business of minding the content for the minders? Don't we have a problem with the minders themselves and in the private business that is Facebook, much less promoting collusion between the government and the social media platforms? That's the road you want to go down. There's nothing troubling about that to
well,
people.
Well, also, too, this, and I don't know if you want to get into it now, but Amy Klobuchar, senator from Minnesota, you know her, was talking about this dirty dozen and that we're not done with them yet. So how long has the government been spying on citizens like that? Because they don't like what they, you know, are saying on social media platforms.
For months now, I've been taking on the dirty dozen, 12 people responsible for something like 60% of this misinformation. Some of them have been taken off of their accounts, but there's more to do. I think we also should look at changing the liability standards when it comes to vaccine misinformation. Senator Warner and Hirono and I already introduced a bill that would focus on discriminatory content and the like. When we have a public health crisis and people are dying every day, enough is enough. These are the richest companies in the world. They are, Dana. There is absolutely no reason they shouldn't be able to monitor this better and take this crap off of their platforms that are basically telling people, oh, hey, there's problems, when we know science proves there isn't.
So what's the crap, Senator Klobuchar? Of course, Dana Bash didn't follow up to demand specific. What's the crap? Is it just crap, in quotation marks, from people who are opposed to vaccines, sort of categorically the anti-vaxxers, if you will? It doesn't require spying. They put this out into the public arena. They're not bashful about it. So what is the crap and where are the lines? Simple questions. Since Senators Klobuchar, Hirono, and whoever else have it all figured out, what is the crap? Define it. Is there any limiting principle to the crap? Or is it just whatever you decide is misinformation on any given day? You and Dr. Murthy and his ministry.
They want more Republican lawmakers to come forward and say, take the vaccine.
Yeah. People who aren't vaccinated are really tragically dying. So part of this is Republicans standing up like Rob Portman just did and commending the vaccines and asking people to get it. And more Republicans doing that and more people who
practically in tears.
Maybe didn't even vote for Joe Biden, standing up and telling the truth.
What does that have to do with anything?
I watched the whole interview and that was
congratulations. That's not an accomplishment. So what is a Republican calling on Republicans to repeat what they're saying have to do with the underlying issue?
They just want more control. They want everyone to get vaccinated. Until everyone's not vaccinated, they're going to sit up there.
Yeah, I understand.
Rip on social media and vaccine shame.
Try and think bigger than Amy Klobuchar. I know that's a challenge. She's a dizzying intellect. Take this crap off. We have legislation. They should be able to do a better job. They should be able to filter this stuff. Take this crap off. What is the crap? Does anybody know? I'd like to know.
I think the crap is misinformation about the vaccine.
And where? What is? So
that's
so
the crap. Like the people.
Specifics.
I mean, people
go.
Are dying.
Give me the
that have
give
gotten,
me the exhaustive list of what constitutes crap in terms of misinformation about the vaccine.
I can't get into her head. I only listened to the interview and thought crap about the vaccine. There, it's true. Some people have died from taking this vaccination, from taking the vaccine, whether it be Johnson & Johnson or Pfizer or Moderna. I think that's what she's talking about when she says take this crap off.
She's talking about taking the crap off the off of social media that details people who have died from taking the vaccine. She just said the science is clear that there's nothing, there's no problems with the vaccine. She's saying the opposite. She's saying that crap would include potentially any discussion of adverse outcomes from taking the vaccine, wouldn't it? This is the no dissent regime. This is the no discussion regime. We have opinions. We have some opinions supported by some data. But whatever we have, the debate is over. That's what this crowd is. The debate is over on everything in the name of science and the name of saving lives. Anything. Pick one. Spin the wheel. Come up with a topic area. You want to talk about energy policy and climate? The debate is over. We need to do X, Y, and Z. Done. Anything else is misinformation. And it's killing people because we're not doing the things we need to stave off the apocalypse. But there is one thing that she talked about with liability exposure for social media companies that a lot of conservatives agree with. Like Josh Hawley and others. And it's one thing to say you're a publisher, you're not indemnified from slander litigation, for example. It's another thing to say they need to have liability for what? Legal liability for misinformation of about a particular topic. What does she want to see them charged like under wrongful death litigation? They advanced misinformation that was the proximate cause of somebody not getting the vaccine and then they died. So you sue Facebook. She's an attorney. And of course, Dana Bash is your typical vacuous teleprompter reader, so none of these questions get explored. All of these questions should be explored when you hear, you know, friends and those in your social circle repeat thoughtlessly the same things that you hear from Dana Bash and Jake Tapper and that yapping terrier Chuck Todd and everybody else on the Sunday talkies. Limiting principles, boundaries, are there any? What constitute, define these terms you're using very generically, misinformation. Is it just about the vaccine or is it anything that could come under the umbrella of saving lives, public safety? Do we understand the road we're down here with Murthy's Ministry of Truth? Dave and Lansing, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, I'm kind of getting tired of you two attacking Facebook because I saw Mark Zuckerberg on an electric wakeboard with an American flag, and that means he's supporting America. America is gold. So that's the thing, you know, you're killing people.
Zuckerberg on a surfboard, right.
4th of July post, yeah, that's what he's talking about.
Right. So the yeah.
I think he was being sarcastic.
He's being sarcastic, yeah. But how do you drive an understanding of something by one person or one agency saying this is the truth, end of discussion, or by having these discussions in perpetuity? Are you allowed to have an incorrect view, an incorrect opinion in this country?
No, you can't.
I mean, if, for example, since Kathleen Sebelius, the former HHS director, said you can't see your kids or go to your job, you shouldn't be able to if you're unvaccinated. She compared being unvaccinated to driving drunk.
Or having cancer and not getting chemotherapy or radiation.
What if my opinion was that there is no evidentiary support that impaired driving results in more accidents, more injuries, more death. There's no evidence, so impaired driving should not be illegal. That's my view. Is that backed up by the science? No, but it's my view. Am I allowed to have that view? Am I allowed to have that view in America? Or do I need to be banished from social media because I have a view that isn't supported by the data on drunk driving, on driving impaired? Can somebody then respond with studies and say, well, Dan, you're wrong. Actually, it turns out there is a heightened incidence of accidents that lead to injuries and death with impaired drivers. And the impaired driver is more likely to cause an accident that leads to injury or death by, you know, this delta. And then you have a conversation, and then everybody can witness that conversation, and reasonable people can come to their own conclusions. Probably most people will agree with the person that uses the evidence to support the contention that impaired driving should be illegal because there is a heightened incidence at the hands of impaired drivers of accidents that lead to injury or death. But can we have that discussion? We can't, because nobody's allowed to be uninformed. And the source of information is Murthy's Ministry of Truth. That's the society you want to live in? Tim in Woodstock.
Morning, Dan and Amy. You know, they kind of look at us as a group of deplorables that I think they're, you know, we're groping around looking for information, someone to lead us out, someone to, you know, keep people from allowing us to go astray. And, you know, I can look at the death rates. I can look at the death rates in my category and make an intelligent decision about the risk of the vaccine and the risk of dying from COVID. I heard one doctor say a while back, what is it about the 2023 clinical trials that you don't understand? That I can look at the risk. I can make a decision for myself. As Amy was talking about the example with cancer, I can choose to get chemotherapy. A person can choose to fight it without it if they wish. You know, that's their choice. Why is this being treated so differently? It's there's something more behind this whole thing, and I can't quite figure out what it is, but.
Thanks, Tim. Masks, CDC. Masks should be worn indoors by all individuals age 2 or older who are not fully vaccinated. Of course, the vaccine is not approved even for emergency use for under 12. So you can't look at the data and the lived experience of the Western world, the entire world, actually, over the last year and a half and say, why does my 2-year-old have to wear a mask on an airplane or in a classroom? Or my 3-year-old or 4-year-old or 5-year-old? Why? What's the basis? We can't make a risk assessment on that and suggest that there really is no basis, particularly when, for example, this cohort, you're not requiring vaccinations to be mask-free as it pertains to the flu shots. You're not requiring the flu shot as it pertains to wearing masks and resuming pre-COVID-19 life for, 0 to 12-year-olds who are more threatened by the flu than COVID, as the data reflects at present. You can't have that conversation?
No. And even in Wheaton School District 200, where the superintendent says he's going to have masks be optional, Pritzker, oh, no. School districts that choose to disregard this guidance not only are putting students and staff at risk, but also taking on expensive liability. There's that word again. That was his response to...
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, fine. I mean, the vaccines, by the way, themselves, 12 plus. What was the news out this weekend that there doesn't expect to be formal authorization of the vaccines by FDA until January?
December, January, yeah.
Okay, so that's another semester. This should be interesting, huh?
Oh, I'm so sick to my stomach about what's coming down the pipe.
I'm Tom in Deer Park.
Boy, Dan, am I glad I got a hold of you. Thanks for taking my call. Can you explain to me this new post-liberal conservatism, this so-called common good conservatism, how so many people can hold the position of being anti-mask, anti-vax, and pro-life all at the same time? And there's so many people out there that hold that view. Can you explain that to me, the congruence of that?
Thanks for the call, Tom. Anti-mask, anti-vax, and pro-life. That's there's something fundamentally inconsistent about that. Well, I mean, the science and the data behind masks that we've gone over ad nauseum as each study has been presented suggests that what? Wearing a mask is saving a life? Show me that data, Tom. Anti-vax, meaning they're categorically anti-vax, they don't get their children vaccinated at all, or they're just a little bit jumpy about this vaccine that isn't even approved for emergency use authorization for 12 and under, and is only emergency use authorization for 12 plus, and you have the government not leveling with you about adverse outcomes, and you're also having them suppress any conversation that would drive perhaps a more enlightened understanding of the whole thing. Yeah, you are confused, Tom, in Deer Park, on so many levels, actually.
Coming up on Chicago's Morning Answer.
At 6:06, we'll switch gears. Hasbro is not just putting out Transformers. They're also in the business of transforming children. Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So another whistleblower has come forward to Project Veritas. This time, it's a young packaging engineer at Hasbro. His name is David Johnson. And he came forward to share exactly what's going on inside of Hasbro.
That nice little Hasbro toy company?
As it pertains to indoctrinating employees to inform the products that Hasbro is producing to advance the agenda of this Conscious Kid organization that's partnering not just with Hasbro, but with YouTube and a lot of other major companies in America to eradicate racism before it takes hold in the young. And by the young, I mean like infants. Infants. Here's what Hasbro is doing in the employee training, and we'll build from here.
How are they indoctrinating children?
They are attempting to covertly push CRT, critical race theory, through branding and messaging through their products.
Explain what we're looking at here.
This is the program developed by the Conscious Kid, which is working with Hasbro. I'm not sure exactly to what extent, but this is their program to teach children about, well, teach is a strong word, but they want to introduce children into racial bias at an early age before they're really able to understand what race and racism is.
Is this a mandatory all hands training?
Yes. And this meeting was attended by, well, you can see at least 44 people.
It was mandatory for him. And by the way, David Johnson is a young black man as well, the packaging engineer who is blowing the whistle on the corporate indoctrination going on at Hasbro for the purposes of advancing the branding in the direction of anti-racism, which is to say racism. Some excerpts from what those Hasbro employees were exposed to. Here we go with the race hustlers that are brought in as consultants on the topic. Katie Ishizuka Stevens talking about the Conscious Kid.
Let's take a look at the tape of the training.
I think we should
be recorded.
By 3 to 6 months, babies are beginning to notice and already express preference by race. There was research that looked at how by 6 months, infants living in a homogenous or same race neighborhood showed preferences for faces from their own racial groups, whereas infants living in more racially diverse environments did not show that same preference for their own racial group. And this is really important because we see that early exposure to different races is impacting these preferences before babies are even 1 year old. Children as young as 2 are already using race to reason about people's behaviors, and We may see this play out in daycare or on the playground and in how kids are starting to choose or exclude playmates and friends.
Are you kidding me? Obviously, this woman doesn't have children. Or she would never be spewing off like that with such nonsense. How do they allegedly know this?
This little white girl
that they put in a test study didn't play with a black girl?
There have been studies, yes. There have been studies that show this. There's a study by Katrina Olson at Princeton, Yarrow Dunham at Yale, Christine Palker, University of Hawaii, National Foundation studied, as well as Mayling Hallam, Associate Professor of Psychology at California State Long Beach, and Sarah Gaither, Assistant Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Duke. And they find that this is essentially what they're citing in their discussion of how children begin to recognize race and process race as young as 3 to 6 months old. And then that obviously the questions follow, well, how do we prevent them from not being biased against people that look differently than when they're 3 to 6 months old? Sure. Course.
I mean, come on.
Yeah, no. You got to get to the anti-racist indoctrination straight away.
They can't even crawl sometimes at that.
Yeah, but here's the problem. By 5, they're David Duke.
By age 3, children are already starting to apply stereotypes, and research shows that they also may use racist language intentionally at this age. And white children at this age may report explicit or overt negative attitudes towards people of color. So already by age 3, this can happen. By age 4, kids are showing a strong and consistent pro-white, anti-black bias. And at this age, it is seen in the research really significantly against black boys. But this anti-black bias occurs across gender at this age. At the age of 5, children show many of the same racial attitudes held by adults. By this age, children are really also sensitive to the status of different racial groups in our society and show a high status bias towards white people, which is a socially privileged group in our society. White children show pro-white bias at this age, and it's really important to note also that black and Latinx children do not show the same in-group preference for their own racial groups at this age.
These 5-year-old white supremacists? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. What do you want to do about the white supremacists living in your home right now, that toddler? Yeah. It's like Damien.
I mean,
everybody's got a white supremacist
within.
By the way,
they're in the house.
This is really has to be jarring for all of those Marxists, the P-Hat Mafia, the Chardonnay Antifa, the new neo-Nazis in Hinsdale and Wilmette and River Forest, because you heard what you said, right? Kids that grow up in less diverse environments where they don't see black and Latino faces are more likely to develop these biases starting as young as 3 to 6 months old.
We better move to a more diverse neighborhood then.
Well, in Lily White, I mean, I want to hear from Lily White, Wilmette, and Glencoe, and Highland Park, and Hinsdale, River Forest, largely. All these upper-income, champagne socialist enclaves that are white and that are all on board for the I hate white people stuff. What about the white supremacists you have at home because of the community in which you live? Did you think about that?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Well, one thing you can do, we can all do together, is demand more products. I don't think there'll be much demand required. Demand more products from Hasbro that do not perpetuate anti-blackness and that close the racial empathy gap. Sure.
We also see a lot of invisibility in products and media, and especially in children's products and media when it comes to communities of color. This also has an impact in communicating whose lives and stories are worthy of being represented and celebrated. Regarding product content and anti-blackness, a large portion of media or products are centered around or perpetuates anti-blackness. And research shows that negative or deficient depictions of blackness in media and products perpetuates this anti-blackness, as well as aversive racial attitudes toward black people. And beyond attitudes, this can have an actual impact on interactions with black people. And for both kids and adults, stereotypes in the product and content can reinforce dangerous hostility and resentment towards marginalized community, and also exacerbate a lack of empathy, which is known as the racial empathy gap.
Mm-hmm.
The racial empathy gap.
Did you know that the toys that you were allowing your kids to play with are exacerbating the racial empathy gap? What's the missing part of this conversation? Even if you stipulate to the research, which I don't, but even if you stipulate to all the research, what is missing from the distillation of that research as it pertains to how kids actually grow up and how they actually interact with people different than them? David Johnson, I think, kind of sort of gets it, which is probably why he's a whistleblower.
Mm-hmm.
David Johnson, the black packaging engineer at Hasbro, who brought this to James O'Keefe at Project Veritas, he had this to say in response to the, you know, the invisibility of black representation in toys and so forth, and this creates a racial empathy gap. This is what he said.
Yeah, I guess the point they're trying to make there is that you will see less, I guess, dolls or toys specifically for or for people with darker skin, which might be true. But again, we're not supposed to be a society where the black people only play with the black toys and the white people only play with the white toys. Mm. And to me, that's not progress. It's regress. It's a regress of the civil rights era and the progress that was made there.
That's a wonderfully revolutionary thought, isn't it? A white girl can play with a black Barbie and a black girl can play with a white Barbie. Is that true? Is that a revolution? Is that obvious? Here's David Johnson's summation on the whole thing. Sharp young guy.
I think we'd be fools to say that there is no racism in the world, but teaching children to judge others based upon race is not going to make a world with less racism. It's going to make a world with more of it.
Yeah, and that's what we're doing with all of this stuff everywhere, all the time, from pre-K. Here, according to these Hasbro consultants, 3 to 6 months old, 3 months old on up, till you get to corporate America. And so I know, you know, so we get responses from listeners. Oh, this race crap. I'm so sick of the black white thing. Yeah, I agree. What do you want to do? Ignore it? You want to let the Marxists have the run of the place? Have you noticed what's happening in your kids' schools, at your workplaces, in all the cultural institutions and entertainment institutions and so forth? I mean, this is the orthodoxy that eliminates your ability to talk about anything else. It also is assigning privileges and responsibilities based on race. So you may want to perk up and pay a little attention, even if you don't want to. I mean, it's only your freedom and the future of this country that's on the line. No less, by the way. Not hyperbole. So appreciate David Johnson having the guts to do this and bring this forward and have an intelligent conversation about what's going on at Hasbro. Pretty big influence, not just a big influencer because it's a big company, because of its products, for goodness sakes. Probably more impactful than what's going on, at least in the primary grades, is the toys and the marketing behind the toys. And what are these toy companies great at doing? Getting the kids to beg their parents to get this toy and that toy.
Oh, yeah. That's how they survive.
You're propagandizing to the kids, and they're enlisting their parents rather than the converse. Jordan in Forest Park.
Good morning. Hey, I'm wondering if critical race theory involves teaching children that white children are inferior to Asian students. Because they're certainly, Asian students are usually top of the class, most schools. So shouldn't they be teaching that?
Well, it's not about superior, thanks for the call, Jordan. It's about oppression and victim. Right. So should they be teaching Asians are oppressors of whites? I mean, it's about as robust intellectually as anything else that Ibram Kendi has to say and so many of these hustlers. But it's more than a hustle, and it's more just to line the pockets of Hasbro's consultants. It's opposing a racial order. And David Johnson, the whistleblower, gets it. The interview is like 27 minutes long. It's worth a look at Project Veritas. He gets it, which is why he came forward, because he gets the bigger play here. Unfortunately, most people don't. Oh, it's just a bunch of, you know, shakedown artists like Sharpton and Jackson. Eh, next level. You're not thinking big enough. They are, by the way. And in terms of critical race theory, particularly for those who, and I think this is an interesting conversation, whether or not state should be in the business of banning it. And I'm opposed to that, partly because I don't think the state should be in the business of imposing a state curriculum on K through 12 schools, particularly a local issue. But for those like David French and even Robbie George at Princeton, who suggests that you have to have space here, that we shouldn't be banning critical race theory studies. You know, it's a little bit more complicated than they want to present it. And to them and anybody else who agrees with the David French, Robbie George opinion, I would just say, okay, all right, yeah, that needs to be part of the curriculum, not the entire thing, but part of it. Okay. Would you take the same position, and would David French and Robbie George take the same position, if critical race theory proposed the opposite? Propose that black people are oppressing white people in this country, that blacks are all oppressors and whites are all victims. Would you then say, oh, well, we need, you know, I don't agree with that, but we need to create a space for it? I doubt David French and Robbie George would say that. So, you know, part of it is in these spaces, is there the opportunity for more than just critical race theory, this racial indoctrination, this institution of a racial order through brainwashing? Is there space for, is there the allowance for other conversation, which is why I'm suggesting the real test, say you go teach your Ibram Kendi, as long as you give me a John McWhorter and a Shelby Steele and a Glenn Lowry and so forth. And when they won't give you a John McWhorter and a Shelby Steele and a Glenn Lowry, then you know what's afoot. And then it's a little bit difficult to say, oh, well, you just, you know, have to recognize this is part of it. No. Mm-mm. A little bit more complicated. Larry and Bartlett.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering if little white kids, if they become racist because they have minimal exposure to black and brown kids in their neighborhood, do black and brown kids become racist because they have minimal exposure to white kids in their own neighborhoods?
Can't be racist. Nice try. Can't be racist because they're marginalized populations. They're the victims. Cannot be racist because racism is about power. That's what you're going to get back. I mean, I say again, I've mentioned this before, you know, I grew up in Wheaton. I don't know. I don't think I had there was a black student in my class in grade school. There were like three or four black students out of a class of 300 at my high school in Bennett.
Mm-hmm. How'd you get along?
Famously. Never had a problem. You know why? Because what the question I asked before about what was missing from this conversation about, you know, kids unconsciously at 3 months old start to view this and view that. What's missing from the conversation, even if you accept the research as fact, which I don't, but even if you do, like I remember when Mimi Raul, who was a black student at Bennett Academy, she was one of the popular girls in the class because she was just fun. She's a great personality. But what you miss is, well, how are you being raised? How are you being schooled? Are you being raised like I was in a Catholic household where you're taught that everybody is equal in the eyes of God and we're all created in his image? Is that being reinforced at the school that you go to as well? You're no better or worse than anybody else. It's your behavior that's determinative, that we all have to abide these commandments and we all should be engaged in these beatitudes and so forth. Because then, so I come across somebody different than me, so what? Yeah, we've tackled that topic in my household. We tackled that topic in my school. I don't need, a Benetton ad representation in my classroom to appreciate that different people from different cultures have different perspectives and bring different experiences to the table. And that's fun. And that should be welcomed. Of course, this is why I always say diversity doesn't need an ambassador. It occurs naturally among the human species. All these diversity shepherds to make sure everything's just so perfectly diverse. They're goons, if you haven't figured that out yet. Kevin in Northfield.
Hey, Dan. What's not being talked about is that the police across the country used to be mostly white, and they had police dogs, and these police dogs were used to white policemen. Then as the police departments integrated, the police dogs were confused, and you had the racist police dogs, but you could train them with these racist police dog whistles, these racist dog whistles. And thank God for that, right?
Okay, Kevin. I'm confused now. Candace in Mount Pleasant.
This stuff started filtering in about 3 years ago when I was a volunteer over at the Boys and Girls Club. Somebody started sending in all these CRT books. And it was really awkward because the director wanted me to read them out loud and, you know, for literacy and everything. And so these kind of books were coming in, Dan, around 2-3 years ago. So this has been a plan in the works for a while. But also I wanted to state that I lived at 41st and Drexel, not Lincoln Park. And some of the kids down there had never even, like, been around white people ever. And were scared to death. So this whole premise, it seems like they're trying to do some kind of supremacy, like some kind of brainwash. Because, I mean, they're the neighborhood that's not integrated at all.
Yeah, well, this is the whole thing. Thanks for the call, Candace. I mean, the whole thing going on right now, and it sort of started, I mean, like all so much of this on a college campus, or at least metastasized on a college campuses, because I remember this even when I was an undergrad, which is the self-segregation in black fraternities and black sororities, black student unions and so forth. What the hell's with that? And so now it's black faculty and white faculty have separate meetings. It's a black student assembly and a white student assembly. So all of, I mean, this is the, I've said it 1,000 times and this will be 1,001. Wait, all of trying to progress from the unenlightened institutions of slavery and Jim Crow through Brown v. Board of Education and the Civil Rights Movement. All of what thoughtful people from American history had to say, from Frederick Douglass to Martin Luther King to the Shelby Steeles and Bob Woodsons of today. That's all for naught. Now we're going to self-segregate after all that fighting about, properly so, about the noxiousness of separate but equal. Now we're going to do separate but equal? Voluntarily, and it's just going to be under a new racial order where it's black as the beneficiary and white as the guilty party that has to make amends and pay reparations and so forth. And you think that's going to produce a better America than pursuing the I have a dream America that King outlined? I mean, who really believes that's going to drive better outcomes, a better society, a more just society, since justice is one of those watchwords of the left? Who really believes that? Why isn't anybody challenged on that?
Coming up on Chicago's Morning Answer.
We'll get back to all things COVID and Delta variant related with Dr. Reed Spalding, contributing American Spectator and practicing pathologist, 636. Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This next segment is sure to be taken down from YouTube and
all
social media because we're going to challenge some of the pronouncements from the Biden administration and Dr. Murthy's Ministry of Truth as it pertains to social media, misinformation, the Delta variant, and the like. By the way, Dr. Murthy, the Minister of Truth, disagreeing with former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb about the mask mandate in L.A. County. Murthy saying it certainly makes sense in the light of the spike in cases associated with the Delta variant. Dr. Scott Gottlieb saying quite the opposite.
I don't think it's the right move. I don't think you can tell people who've been vaccinated that they have to wear a mask. I think, quite frankly, it's likely to be the exception. I think you're likely to see very few states and municipalities do this because there's not going to be a lot of support for mandates at this point. People who are worried about COVID have largely been vaccinated. I realize not everyone has been able to get vaccinated, but most people have been vaccinated who are worried about this infection. And people who remain unvaccinated aren't worried about the infection and don't want to be wearing masks either. Now, the bottom line is that means this is just going to spread through the population. And that's why the models look so bad. There's some models being worked on right now. CDC has one, I'm told, that show an increasing epidemic, a wave of infection from this Delta variant moving through the population over the next 2 months. Those models, the assumptions built into those models is no mitigation. No mandates for masks, no closures of businesses. I think that's likely to be the norm. And also, you know, when you get vaccinated, you're less likely to spread the infection, less likely to contract the infection. So people who are vaccinated aren't putting the population, by and large, at risk. So telling them that they have to wear masks indoors, I think it creates a disincentive to go out and get vaccinated in the first place.
It's interesting that he properly describes it as less likely to transmit, less likely to get infected. Oh, you mean something's not fail-safe? Oh, you mean there's an assessment there? There's a trade-off to be done. Sort of like the trade-off of saying, let's see, the COVID survival rate under the age of 70, case infection rate, survival rate is 99.95%. Maybe I'm not so interested in the vaccine if I'm otherwise young and healthy. Is that kind of trade-off where you're looking at percentages in a imperfect world? For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Dr. Reed Spaulding, who's a contributor to the American Spectator, practicing pathologist. All opinions expressed are his and not those of his employer. Hopefully that will do enough to insulate him from Dr. Murthy's Ministry of Truth. Dr. Spaulding, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Good to be with you.
So the models, the Delta variant, and particularly against the backdrop of news out of Israel, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett saying, we do not know exactly what to what degree the vaccine helps, but it is significantly less mRNA vaccines with the Delta variant.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's somewhat less, but it's still protecting against severe disease, right? It's still protecting people against having to go to the hospital or, you know, from dying. So it still offers good protection, the vaccines do, against the variant. The most important thing to keep in mind about the variant is that they don't have the fatality rates that the alpha variant had, right? It's more contagious, but it's also less likely to kill you. So there is a silver lining with the Delta variant as it spreads through the population.
Well, what do you think about the LA County now enforcing masks, whether you're vaccinated or not indoors?
Well, I think it's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I echo the comments that you just played from Scott Gottlieb. I mean, what's the point of telling people that they need to get a vaccine if then they have to go around living life like they didn't, right? It makes no sense. It does nothing but disenfranchise people who maybe still haven't got vaccinated, who are on the fence. I mean, I can't imagine there's that many of those left, but if they are, if they still have to wear a mask, what's the point? That's what they're thinking when they hear that type of policy come down in L.A. So it's nonsense.
Well, the other thing, too, is, I mean, just to put an underline on your statement that it's less lethal than the alpha iteration of COVID-19. Well, that's not what I'm receiving when I hear social media is killing people with misinformation, and I hear that the unvaccinated, it's an epidemic among the unvaccinated, and people are going to die, be hospitalized and die, and so on and so forth. I don't hear that that texture you provided about it being less lethal very often.
Well, no, because that goes against the campaign of trying to encourage people to get vaccinated. I mean, I think for adults, it makes a lot of sense to get this vaccine. I've been saying it since day one, especially for adults who are elderly or who have underlying conditions that predispose them to a bad outcome from COVID. But I think that's been the problem from public health officials this whole time. They haven't been giving it to people straight. And when you don't give it to people straight, when you only present some of the data and not all of the data, when people catch on to that, they don't trust you anymore. And, you know, we need to have faith in our public health officials, and they've done a lot of damage, I think, to their credibility, at least a lot of them have, over the past year and a half.
Why haven't they stressed to people, to the American people, I don't care if they're Republican or Democrat, hey, talk to your doctor and, you know, converse with your doctor to see whether or not you should get the vaccine, instead of this, get the vaccine or you're not going to have your freedoms?
Well, I don't know. I think it goes just back to the nature maybe of, you know, the bureaucracy in general. I think you're going to have a bigger fight, though, coming up when you start talking about this being authorized for young kids, which, you know, they're currently doing the clinical trials I'm working on. I think that's a trickier question, at least for me. You know, the risk-benefit of young children getting this vaccine, I don't know for sure that comes out to where it makes sense that they should get it. I mean, a young child's risk, and when I say young, I mean 10 or under, their risk of dying from a COVID infection is 0.002%. That's what one meta-analysis I've read said. So, you know, when you're talking numbers like that, then you start having to ask yourself, well, what are the side effects? How sick is little, you know, Johnny or Susie going to be from just the vaccine itself? And
right. What's
the trade-off there? It's not apparent to me at all that everybody needs to go out and get, you know, this shot for their 5-year-old, because this isn't a disease of 5-year-olds, right? It's a disease of 95-year-olds.
Yeah, that's the conversation.
At least we're talking about bad outcomes.
Yeah, that's the conversation we've been trying to have about this for months on end, and just very few people seem willing to engage on that. Maybe it's because everything is drowned out by such statements like St. Fauci made over the weekend, that with the level of misinformation out there today about the vaccines, we could not have eradicated smallpox or polio.
Oh, well, I don't think that's the case at all, because those were, you know, having very harsh impacts on children. I mean, you know, well, people were craving a polio vaccine because it was devastating to children's lives, right? So if COVID was killing high numbers of children, God forbid, you would definitely have people feeling different about it. But it's like, I kind of compare it to the flu, right? I mean, flu is 3 to 4 times more deadly for children than COVID is. We don't make them get the flu vaccine every year. We don't make them wear masks in school every year. We don't do any of these things. And it's, when you put it in the context of that, people need to just take it in stride and realize, you know, exactly what we're talking about here, the population that's most affected by this, and take all the data in. Don't just focus on the narrative.
Over the weekend, Dr. Vivek Murthy, he's the Surgeon General, don't you know, was asked by Dana Bash if Fox News and other right-wing outlets are killing people with misinformation. Sort of a remarkable position that Dr. Murthy's taking with, and the Biden administration generally, with respect to alleged misinformation. They want social media to come in and clamp down on people who say things that ask uncomfortable questions, or even say things that are untrue. And my question earlier in the show, I'll put it to you, is so science is predicated on testing hypotheses, which are educated guesses. So if you can't communicate things that may or may not be true, may turn out to be not true, and have debate about them in open forum, then doesn't that have a chilling effect on the pursuit of knowledge and understanding what is and isn't true?
Certainly. Yeah, I mean, the ability to have an open debate about issues is pretty central to everything, I think, in this country, whether it be science or, you know, talk about civil liberties or any of it. I don't really understand the push behind all the censoring that they're trying to do. I mean, I think you could argue that some of what they put out is misinformation, or at least not the complete information, right? They only put out certain things that make their agenda, that further it. But they leave out some important details as well. For instance, to go back to the Delta variant, yes, it is true that in areas of the country that aren't vaccinated, there are little pockets of outbreaks that are firing up. I was reading in Arkansas where the I think only 30-something percent of adults are vaccinated, they're having an increase in cases, a lot of those being the Delta variant. But they leave out the fact that it's less lethal than right. the original variant. And that's how, you know, that's just kind of a concept in evolutionary virology, that if something becomes more transmissible, the trade-off for that virus is it's typically less virulent, less likely to kill you. So I think we're all getting a real-time education and evolution, really, as this thing unfolds.
Something else, too, on vaccinations, just in terms of this misinformation thing. So it's all the focus is on so-called right-wing outlets and asking questions or even expressing skepticism. And yet when you look at the distribution in America by race in terms of vaccination levels, Asians, 62%, whites, 47%, Hispanics, 39%, blacks, 34%. So, I mean, it's sort of unlikely that Fox would be driving down the percentage of vaccinations among blacks or Latinos, given the composition, relative composition of their audiences to the more left leaning outlets, too. So, I mean, it just fails sort of on the logic of it. But it also speaks to it's a cultural issue, not just a public health informational issue. You can listen to Tony Fauci or you can listen to somebody else, but there's still other variables that go into these individual decisions that are being made at the micro level. And that's something else that we don't hear our government commissars really contemplate.
Right. I think in general, they want people to feel divided. And I think in a lot of ways they're succeeding. I mean, you take these latest recommendations that I was writing about from the CDC, that the kids under 12 that aren't vaccinated need to keep wearing masks in the fall. Whether or not that happens to your child probably largely depends on if there's a governor in charge of your state or if it's a Democrat governor or a Republican governor. And it shouldn't be that, you know, it should just be the fact that, you know, 1 in 50,000 kids dies with COVID and make your decision based on that, not based on politics.
Do you think that politicians are, you know, not telling us the truth about the Delta variant? So in order to scare people to get vaccinated and get their kids vaccinated?
I think that they are leaving out that fact because were they to say that on a regular basis, it would make some people think, yeah, maybe I don't need to get vaccinated. So, yeah, the answer to your question is yes, I suppose. Yeah, I think they're not saying that because if they do, not everybody will get vaccinated.
Dr. Reed Spalding, contributing to the American Spectator, practicing pathologist. All of the opinions he expressed are his own and not those of his employer, so he can maintain his employment. Dr. Spalding, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. You guys have a good day.
Thanks, you too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, and this is interesting. The Olympic Village in Japan, Tokyo Olympics there.
Yeah.
Athletes are starting to arrive at their accommodations ahead of the July 23rd start of the Olympics. And they are arriving to find anti-sex beds.
Oh, excuse me.
Anti-sex beds made from cardboard that are designed only to be able to withstand the weight of one person. The beds are expected to break with any sudden movements, and they are recyclable so as to avoid the spread of COVID through carnal relations.
No way. I covered the Olympics, and there's a lot of that hanky-panky stuff going on, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. The restraint and the discipline to become an Olympic athlete, but you need to be minded over by the IOC when it comes to your sleeping quarters. And this also interesting. I like the contrast here. Anti-sex beds stop the spread of COVID, Japan Olympics, passing out condoms in the Chicago public school system.
Oh, yeah, in fifth grade.
I guess they're just going to do it anyway in fifth grade at CPS, but not in Tokyo. Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Black Lives Matter formally siding with Cuban dictators. Black Lives Matter condemns the U.S. federal government's inhumane treatment of Cubans and urges it to immediately lift the economic embargo. this cruel and inhumane policy instituted with the explicit intention of destabilizing the country and undermining Cubans' right to choose their own government is at the heart of Cuba's current crisis. Since 1962, the United States has forced pain and suffering on the people of Cuba by cutting off food, medicine, and supplies, costing the tiny island an estimated $130 billion. Without that money, it's harder for Cuba to acquire medical equipment needed to develop its own COVID-19 vaccines and equipment for food production. This comes in spite of the country's strong medical care and history of lending doctors and nurses to disasters around the world. It's a wonderful statement by Black Lives Matter because it's an indication of their understanding, not just of the history of Cuba, but the history of America. So when you think about the 1619 Project, that ahistorical account of America, think of this current statement from Black Lives Matter on Cuba, because it's the sort of rewriting of the history that's going on by these neo-Marxists. Well, this prompted the Black Lives Matter statement prompted rebukes on editorial pages, and also this black Cuban gentleman to take to TikTok to offer this response.
Directly to Black Lives Matter movement. You guys suck. You know why? You know why you guys suck? Because you guys, any of you guys, any live in a communist country, in the socialist country. The day you guys go to Cuba, at least for a month, at least, then you guys can talk about Cuba. Then you guys can talk about Cubans. Cuba is not a paradise. Cuba is not like a pretty island. It's not. Cuba is a dictatorship country. Cuba is a dictatorship government. People are protesting right now in Cuba. They're not protesting because they want the embargo to be off. No. They're protesting because they want to be free. They're protesting in Cuba because they want a freedom. That's why they're protesting. The day that the Cuban people have freedom, the embargo disappears. Any restriction that United States have over Cuba gonna disappear. I see, like that. When the people in Cuba have freedom. In Cuba, you cannot speak. You cannot think. Thinking in Cuba, take you to jail. Speaking in Cuba, take you to jail. In order, that has to be with embargo.
Well, to help adjudicate this debate between Black Lives Matter and that Cuban gentleman, pleased to be joined for our weekly confab with Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, and author of the recently released Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. Who's right?
Well, look, a number of the statements in the Black Lives Matter manifesto are just factually incorrect. The U.S. doesn't sanction or prevent medical or food aid from going to Cuba. That's just not true. Also, it was the Cuban government said they were making their own vaccine. They didn't want foreign help. They produced very little, and it doesn't appear to work. I mean, and there's no mention whatsoever of the large financial reserves of the Cuban government or the fact that they have a very ambitious foreign policy, which includes not just sending doctors, but security forces and all throughout the region, meddling and destabilizing other countries, propping up the Maduro regime in Venezuela, all resources that they could have used to take care of the Cuban people. And there's like no mention. When all the sanctions were lifted under Obama, the regime did nothing. This is just like when we, you know, had the deal with Iran. We said, well, they're going to liberalize, they're going to get better, they're going to be a nice neighbor, they're going to treat their people better. They did none of that, and the Cubans did none of that as well. I mean, the reality is, I'm sure Black Lives Matter people that wrote this know this. The government controls everything in Cuba, in the public and the private sector. Any money that goes in the country flows through their fingers. They're incredibly corrupt. They siphon off what they need. They decide who gets the rest. So when you put money into that country, all it does is it makes the government stronger.
Well, do you think, I mean, Russia was the first country to provide aid in Cuba after three hurricanes, you know, in 2008. Do you think that they're going to be coming in to help Cubans with vaccinations?
Well, the Russian Sputnik vaccine is actually not bad. The Chinese vaccine is kind of worthless, but the Chinese and the Russians will both help prop up the government because they see that as a base in the Western Hemisphere to diminish American power, and that's why it's survived all these years. Cuba is going to be a bigger issue for us because the reality is, since they took the missiles out after the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Cubans have been annoying, but they've never really been a problem. And the reason why they never really a problem is because, by and large, the Atlantic region, from the Arctic to the Antarctic, to Africa, to Latin America, the Caribbean, it was our backyard, and nobody messed with us in our backyard very much. And they were like the annoying neighbors that play their music loud at night. That's changing. You have the Chinese massively intruding into the Western Hemisphere in a very destabilizing way. You still have the Russians messing around. You even have the Iranians messing around in Venezuela. So with having a strong base in the middle of the Western Hemisphere is actually becoming kind of a strategic threat to the United States. Not to mention, they treat their people horribly. I mean, look, this thing's gone on for decades. Decades. And you have people in Cuba who have only grown up under this system. And yet they spontaneously walk out of the streets and say, we hate this government.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that tell you?
What should our government be doing in addition to preparing itself for the UN investigation into human rights violations in America? With respect to Cuba, one of the suggestions, this was offered by the Wall Street Journal editorial board, is repressive regimes when there's a unrest, the first thing they do is shut down channels of communication, particularly in the digital age. And one thing the Biden administration could do is circumvent the cyber wall that Cuba is putting up that prevents communications on social media and so forth, and provide avenues of communication.
Well, we could do that. It's not going to make a huge difference. I think it would be an important symbolic act of resistance and support for the Cuban people, but the reality is internet's very expensive in Cuba. It's not widely proliferated. It's not how everyday people communicate. The reality is you know, the American radio that was broadcasted in Cuba was far, far more effective.
Hmm. Let's move to China for a minute, but China as it relates to the Biden administration, particularly Hunter Biden. Peter Schweitzer, author of Secret Empires and Clinton Cash, was on with Maria Bartiromo yesterday talking about this novel approach to Hunter Biden's foray into the art world. The curator who's pitching his art the world over wants to break into foreign markets, and he sees Hunter Biden's blow art as his real opportunity to do so. This was the concerns that Peter Schweitzer raised in response to questioning from Maria Bartiromo.
Peter, right now, Hunter is getting ready to sell art. He has told us that this is his new job. He is a first-time artist, no training, of course. The pieces are being priced between $75,000 and $500,000 a piece. You call this scheme genius. Why?
Well, it's genius because in a very corrupt way, because what was the criticism of Hunter's previous money-making schemes? When he went to work for Burisma, the energy company, the criticism was he was getting $1 million a year. He had no background in Ukrainian energy regulation, no background in energy. Well, art is different than the business world. It's entirely subjective. So if somebody's prepared to send $500,000 to an artist for a piece of art, who can question it? So in that sense, it's very genius. But this opens the gateway to massive corruption, Maria, because the art owner, the partner that he has that's going to be marketing his art has been very clear that he's going to market these things overseas. He's been wanting to break into the Chinese art market for years. And the Senate actually in 2019 issued a report talking about how the art world is rife with money laundering and corruption involving foreign oligarchs because it's so hard to trace. So it's a massively troublesome problem, and their explanations simply don't carry any weight.
Jim, do you think that Biden's art should be shared with the world? I mean, we shouldn't be allowed to just hoard it all for ourselves in America, should we?
Well, sure. Look, I mean, this is a free enterprise system, so he should be able to do whatever he wants. I don't think the U.S. government should be
brokering or playing a role. I think anything the U.S. government does do, it should be completely transparent. I think this is a clear example where the Biden administration would not be having these problems if they and the mainstream media had allowed the system to work like it's supposed to be. Like, air out their dirty laundry. Don't censor. Don't say there's nothing here. Get it out there, fully investigate it, and let everybody know what's going on, and then voters will make their own decisions. So, in a sense, they asked for this scandal. They asked for this scandal because they tried to say, there's nothing to see here, and you can't look at this. You know, just like the Como brothers and other things, you know, eventually people are going to need to get to the facts and get to the information. And hiding it always comes back to hurt you. And they get what they deserve here. And this is a ridiculous, well, the whole art thing is ridiculous. But the fact that it's mired the government is in this administration, it's their own fault. And it's the media's fault for not doing their job at the front end.
And, Schweitzer went on to say, you know, at least the Clintons with the Clinton Foundation, they disclosed who their donors were so you could have the conversation about, gosh, it's curious that these foreign countries are donating so much money to Hillary Clinton in advance of her presidential campaign, some of these speaking fees at big banks and so forth. At least that was disclosed so you had to stand and deliver on the topic. What we're talking about here is, you know, we're going to protect the anonymity of the donors for some unidentified reason.
First of all, that's just nonsense.
Or purchasers.
Like a donor. Yeah, like a donor, because they're saying, well, we don't know who gave the money, therefore nobody could benefit from this. Like, nothing prevents the donor from telling them that they paid for this stuff. I mean, it's just nonsense that somehow this is insulating them from political influence. I mean, it's ridiculous.
I know, because they could be paying to get access to President Biden.
You know,
right, exactly.
You know,
and,
like,
and they
were
well,
with
we don't know who gave the money.
Right, exactly.
Let me just say, well, I gave the money to Yahoo. I mean, come on.
Yeah, especially when there's a track record, not just, I mean, forget Burisma, which everyone focuses on. How about with Chinese communists and Rosamund Seneca Partners and the billion-dollar infusion into that private equity concern? So all of those questions remain effectively unanswered, and now you have them layering on another scheme.
Well, look, I didn't have problems going. They went after Trump. Fine. And they went after him for years. And you know, in the end, they found nothing. And none of those, I believe, were the reason that Trump lost the election, because I think everybody looked and there was no fire beyond the smoke. What the Biden team did is they hid all this from the public eye, and the mainstream media colluded with them to do that. I mean, they're complaining about misinformation. They're saying people should. And this is exactly what they were doing. I actually think it was stupid. It was stupid on their part, because you can't hide this stuff forever. Eventually it's going to come out. And if there's real wrongdoing there and real illegal activity, like Epstein, somebody's going to catch up with you sooner or later, my friend.
I wanted to get to your reaction to something we talked about on Friday, but we hadn't had a chance to talk to you about it. Your reaction to something I referenced before, Secretary of State Blinken's invitation to the UN to investigate the U.S. for human rights abuses, Jen Psaki summarizing last week.
As the secretary said in his statement, he believes responsible nations must not shrink from scrutiny of their human rights record. Rather, they should acknowledge it with the intent to improve it, and also push and lift up and put shine a light on other countries that need to do better. And that is the role we're playing here from the United States.
Jim?
Yeah, so this is this is just malfeasance. I could say this is a rookie mistake or, a sophomore slump or something, but Blinken's an experienced diplomat who knows better. The reality is these UN groups, beat on the U.S. as part of a political agenda. There's no sense of proportionality here. I mean, the scarce resources that we have in the world to do this, you think we would use that to investigate regimes that are doing brutal, irresponsible activity. But instead, they come after the U.S. because it's politically attractive for them. He knows that. They've done it before. And just allowing them to do it again doesn't make the U.S. look better or morally superior. It's literally, letting the other guy, throw pitches and having the batter bat with his eyes closed. It's just, It's just stupid. I mean, I've used the word stupid about 14 times in this interview. It's only been 5 minutes long. But it's just the dumbest, most amateur diplomacy. And what's scary is it's coming from a very experienced diplomat who knows way better, because they did this under Obama and it never turned out well for the U.S.
Well, I think it's scary. Not that the U.N. and various adversaries of the United States think it's advantageous to do this politically, that the Biden administration thinks it's advantageous to do this politically.
Oh, it's just crazy. I was watching this movie last night, The Flyboys. You remember the Zeppelins?
Yeah.
Okay, you remember the Hindenburg?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is the Biden administration. I mean, it's just like they're going down in flames between open borders and this ridiculous scandal with Biden, and the way they botched up opposing voter rights, and this really stupid move with the UN. It's like, how many ways can give the American people to hate this government? I mean, it's like, do they sit around and say, what can we do to make everyday Americans more angry at us?
Yeah, no. Let's mask the vaccinated, too.
Well, they may be going down in flames, but the question is, who are they taking with them? This report on the fighting culture of the United States Navy Surface Fleet that was conducted at the direction of Senator Tom Cotton and a few members of Congress, including Dan Crenshaw and Mike Gallagher, issues raised, insufficient leadership focus on warfighting, paralyzing zero defect mentality, underinvestment in surface warfare officer training and so forth. I'm sure you're apprised of this. And what does it say? I mean, one of the accomplishments of the Trump administration, touted by Trump, was getting the U.S. military back to military readiness. And this report seems to indicate the Navy's not there.
So this is, reminds me so much of the Carter years in the 1970s with the hauling out of the military. I'm very concerned about this, with a whole bunch of other things, from woke policies to transgender policies. All these things really distracting the military. And I actually wrote this up the other day, and I sent it out to a email loop online with a bunch of military people. And I cannot tell you how many people came back to me and said, this is exactly what's going on. So in the ranks of the military, there's real concern about this. I really am worried that if this continues for a couple of years, that we are undermining the efficiency capability of the military the way we did in the 1970s. I take this as a really, really serious problem.
Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation and author of Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Thanks as always, Jim.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line. Chicago's Morning Answer.
Only the woke need apply at New York City's elite schools at 7:37. Top of the morning, Dan and Dami. Let's talk about the silencing of dissent and the canceling of people who do dissent a little bit more. We began, and we really started on Friday, now that it's been ratcheted up by the Biden administration, Dr. Murthy's Ministry of Truth, not to be confused with Depeche Mode's Policy of Truth.
Oh, there you go.
Very different.
Yes.
Has been doubled down on already, even just over the weekend, by the Surgeon General on CNN, by Jen Psaki on Friday, saying this:
to create robust enforcement strategies that bridge their properties and provide transparency about rules. You shouldn't be banned from one platform and not others if you are for providing misinformation out there.
So now it's a fascinating development. Now, not only do they have recommendations for social media sort of generically, one of them specifically is like NATO. If one is attacked, then all are attacked. If one bans, all ban. Talk about collusion. I tell you, this stuff like that, if these social media companies were able to actually align with the Biden administration recommendations, really gives amazing air to Donald Trump's lawsuit against big tech companies suggesting that they're acting as agents of the state. They would be acting as agents of the state.
Our president of the United States accused Facebook posters of killing people.
That's right.
Think about that. And he doubled down again.
What's your message to platforms like Facebook?
They're killing people.
Oh, my God.
I mean, the only pandemic we have is among the unvaccinated. And they're killing people.
So what do you think is afoot there with this move against social media companies, this move to eliminate dissent, you know, all under the auspices of promoting vaccinations to save lives? Gosh, I wonder if it has something to do with Trump. Trump as an example of a larger phenomenon, which is let's take this this opportunity to squelch regular people from doing anything other than complying. I mean, what was one of the main criticisms of Twitter? It was popular, and then even though it continued to be the playground of so many of the leading lights of the left, very unpopular, and it's unpopular. The social media companies are unpopular among the left chiefly because they don't ban people who disagree, starting with the President of the United States, until they did, of course. But remember, Trump was able to get around the D.C. press corps
by using Twitter.
Right. And now he can't do that.
And that made them mad. And then they turned on him.
And now he can't do that. And now we want to make sure nobody else can either. You know who else upsets them?
Who?
Joe Rogan. You know why he upsets them?
Is he one of the dirty dozen, the 12? That they're trying to silence.
No. You know why he upsets them is because his podcast, I mean, I don't really understand it. I've watched a number of his podcasts, and I mean, I liked him on news radio, but that's about it. And in terms of an interviewer, I don't know. And boy, a couple, 3 hours with him and almost anybody else, and I'm tracing my veins. But but nonetheless, I mean, I respect what he's done.
Right.
He has 200 million downloads an episode. So he also can go around the D.C. press corps. And when it comes time to influence people, to persuade people about a particular person or a particular viewpoint, Joe Rogan is somebody they can't control and say they don't like it. And this is why he's the subject of such criticism, including from that egghead. And I say this not because he's smart. I say it because his head is literally shaped like an egg. Brian Stelter on CNN.
Oh, you can't stand him. And now you made me not stand him either.
Well, I don't know how you watch him.
How did he get that job? But anyway.
He said of Rogan, on one level, it's just comical hearing the rich and famous guy express worries that even though he's paid to talk for a living, he's going to be silenced in the future. But he's not the only one talking that way. The fear about woke culture and overreaction is pervasive, especially in the right wing media. Our friend Christian Toto over at HollywoodandToto.com had a good piece on Rogan and this dynamic in the New York Post, where he suggests the list of complaints from the left about Rogan are telling. He's too willing to give problematic voices, quote unquote, like Abigail Schreier, we've had on this show, a critic of the trans agenda platform. He's too willing to question the government's COVID-19 dog-eared rule book. True. I mean, and, you know, he had a 3-hour, it was actually one of a good episode. I did listen to his 3-hour about conversation with Alex Berenson, who we've had on the show, too, former New York Times reporter, about all things COVID-related. That was actually quite good. Too willing to curse out cancel culture, too enamored of free speech. And he just doesn't march to their beat, and they don't like it. It's okay if you don't march to their beat and you're not influential, or you can be easily stamped out. It's another thing when, you know, you're the number one podcaster in the world. So it's another thing when you're the president of the United States and you can go around them and, you know, you're the number one Twitter account in the world. That has to be squelched. Betsy on the north side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yes, good morning. Hope you're doing well. I watched French television. It's in English. It's called France 24.
How much of it is Jerry Lewis?
Yeah. Yeah, they love him. The remarkable thing, I know the French love to demonstrate, but I saw hundreds of people in the streets demonstrating against the vaccine, carrying signs in French, and I could read French and English, and I'm pretty sure it was in Paris. So we're not an island of people that are opposed to this some of this propaganda. I was really surprised.
Thanks for the call, Betsy. Favorite French film, Amy? Do you have a favorite French film?
I do not, but I have a feeling that I'm going to ask you that question. Dan, do you have a favorite French film?
No, just thinking about it as Betsy was talking, so I'm running the gamut. Battle of Algiers. Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
What's that about?
That's
what's the premise of the film, please?
It's based on, this writer for what was the outlet? Was it Esquire? I can't remember. He was Bobby was his name. He suffered from locked-in syndrome. He had an attack, and the only way he could communicate was by blinking one eye.
Really?
Yeah. And he wrote a book with the help of his nurse, yeah, who liked, you know, they figured out how to communicate letters by blinking one eye. He wrote a book about the experience that was transcribed by the nurse. And it's a really, really good movie. I like the Mazarine series too, about that mobster in France.
Okay.
Anything with Gerard Depardieu, obviously. Other French films, I'll think about it.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
By the way, on CNN, since we brought up that egghead Stelter again, only because his head is shaped like an egg, Bill Burr went nuclear on CNN on his podcast, Bill Burr, comedian. And Bill Burr's no conservative either, so it's interesting, but he's willing to, you know, take on all of the sacred cows wherever they may exist on the left or right. He says, I swear to God, I cannot believe people watch that channel. They're so dumb. They're effing treasonous, un-American pieces of excrement.
Okay.
His mother-in-law, Bill Burr's mother-in-law, always puts on CNN, and you know what those effing morons are doing? You know what those effing morons are doing? They're effing talking about Trump. It's like these,
quit him.
And he's right. He thinks basically what we all know to be true, that we're talking about Trump because he's good for business while Biden is boring and a ratings disaster, as we've seen from the ratings. It's like, do you think these people give a blank who's president? They want Darth Vader to come back. They want him to come back because they had nothing to talk about because it's show business and Joe Biden is an effing bore. They can't bitch about Biden because he's wearing a blue tie. In other words, he's a Democrat. So what do? They're going out there, they're doing what they did the first time to get this guy Trump elected by giving him all this free coverage while they act like they allegedly don't like him. I don't buy it. They're a corporate news channel. Oh, I buy that they don't like him, and I buy that they're in the tank for Joe Biden. I don't think it's just business, but I think for those in charge, it's also business. It's not just. It's also. It's ideologically driven. But we need to keep the lights on, too. Not mutually exclusive. Can be ideological and also about the bottom line. Recently, Michael Wolff was on with Brian Stelter, the egghead, because his head is shaped like an egg. And talking about Michael Wolff's new book on Trump, which we talked a little bit about with Michael Bender from Wall Street Journal, who also has a book out on Trump on Friday. And Michael Wolff, you know, he's sort of a difficult guy to pigeonhole because on the one hand, he came up with in his Fire and Fury book in the first year of the Trump administration, this notion that if it sounds true, it is true. And there were a lot of things in Fire and Fury that really didn't check out. So on the one hand, it's sort of detestable. On the other hand, when he goes after Brian Stelter like this and when he's honest about what he's doing, it's sort of enjoyable.
I think you yourself, while you're a nice guy, you know, you're full of sanctimony. You know, you become part of one of the parts of the problem of the media. You know, you come on here and you have a a monopoly on truth. You know exactly how things are supposed to be done. You are why one of the reasons people can't stand the media. I'm sorry.
You're cracking me up.
It's your fault.
What should I do differently, Michael?
Don't talk so much. Listen more. You know, people have genuine problems with the media. The media doesn't get the story right. The media exists in its own bubble.
That's true.
You know,
I agree.
You got to stop. I mean, that last segment that I just had to listen to of all of the people saying the same old stuff. Also, you're incredibly repetitive. It's week after week. I mean, you're the flip side of Donald Trump. Fake news, and you say virtuous news. You know,
we just figure out what is real.
I mean,
I'm listening.
Figuring out what is real is not so easy. And right. You know, most people don't want to turn to Brian Stelter to tell us what's real. I'm sorry.
Well, then why'd you bother coming on CNN a few times this week?
I'm a book salesman.
Yeah, at least he's honest.
Yeah.
You know, at least he's honest. I'm
here
a book salesman.
I'm trying to push my product.
You know, the Stelter, though, only exists because of the echo chamber, as Wolf is describing it, that is the D.C. press corps. I mean, you know how small these audiences are? We have a bigger audience in Chicago than Brian Stelter does on Reliable Sources nationally, because a lot of these cable news shows have no audience.
Right.
No audience. It's dispersed across the country, and you see them because CNN's on in airports and so on and so forth, but they have no real audience. They have no constituency.
Because people don't trust them. I mean, I'm still waiting for them to apologize for that Officer Sicknick story that they completely ignored.
Well, I know people don't trust them, but the profile they have, why do they enjoy it? Because it's profile that is derived from their allies in this echo chamber in which they reside. So they get profile because their picture's here. They get profile because they get, you know, particular guests that also give them profile, the administration officials and so on and so forth. But in terms of the number of people that watch the shows that we're tasked to watch in part, I mean, it's an infinitesimal percentage of America, certainly. And I said there are radio programs. Joe Rogan has more downloads than CNN will have listeners in a year or viewers in a year.
In one day. Right. One podcast.
And again, it's not necessarily an endorsement of Rogan. It's more of an indictment of CNN. I'll take your calls. Also, my favorite French movie. It was Elle Magazine, by the way. Somebody texted in.
Oh, it wasn't Esquire. It was Elle.
Elle Magazine on Bobie.
See, our listeners are so smart.
The Butterfly and the Butterfly and Diving Belt. That's a great movie.
What year did that come out? Is it a classic?
No. It's in the last 15 years or so. Okay. A classic French movie would be like The Passion of Joan of Arc, which was like in the 20s.
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah, of course.
That was
of
my
course.
Time.
Yeah, Passion of Joan of Arc.
Of course.
Sure. You saw the theater.
Of course.
Yeah.
I actually saw it in Intro to Film in Iowa. Thank you.
Fred in Wonder Lake.
Oh, hi, Fred.
Yes, how you doing this morning?
Good.
I think you guys are right on the money. I think you do have more listeners than CNN, and I think you are right on the money with the compression. Oh, they advertise CNN as being more popular than you guys. They're not. And there's a lot. Dr. Siva, I guess in Connecticut or somewhere out east, where he's uncovered, it's a lawsuit against Twitter. They've uncovered, I guess, the government operations manual in the Twitter document. So I think this is a game changer.
All right. Thanks for the call, Fred. Appreciate it. Mike on the north side.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say, I think CNN's largest demographic are people who fell asleep in the Lazy Boy and the dog jumped on the remote, and that's why it's on CNN. But I think the biggest reason they're pushing this Delta variant is because in Arizona, they're going to throw out a lot of votes, and they may not overturn the presidential election, but it may overturn the Senate election. Huh. And the Republicans may take the Senate back, and they don't want anyone to know about it.
I don't think so. Thanks for the call, though, Mike. But we'll get to Maricopa. If we don't get to Maricopa today, we'll get to it tomorrow. Ralph and Rantoul.
Oh, wait, real quick. We have to thank Mike for making the donation to Maryville Academy, and he made a donation on behalf of you to Mercy Homes.
Why do we have to thank him? He lost a bet. He lost a bet. You pay up.
He actually paid up.
Well, that's what you do.
Within 48 hours,
You don't get thanks. You don't get thanks for doing something you're supposed to do.
Oh.
It's like, thank you for waking up this morning and coming to work. That's what you have to do.
Thank you for coming in. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's the first time I've won a bet and something
forever
paid up.
Yeah. Well, that's because you're somebody who believes Pritzker's not running for re-election. That's why you lose bets. Ralph and Rantoul.
Good morning. Favorite French movie, Babette's Feast, or anything
Babette's
by Jerry
Feast.
Lewis. He was big in France.
I can't believe, thanks for the call, Ralph. Yeah, I've heard that about Jerry Lewis. Thanks for the tip. Babette's Feast is, I can't believe I forgot that. That's I think, my favorite movie all time.
Really? Of all time?
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, Babette's Feast. That's yes. Very good. Thanks for that, Ralph. Finally, some literate thing. I'm so appreciative to have literate
listeners. Remind you of what your favorite film is?
Something CNN also doesn't have. Chad on the South Side.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I love French films. I've got an RV right now. I'm kind of traveling around the country. It's
good
called The Swimming Pool. Charlotte Rampling is nude in it, and she's over 50. Hot stuff, Dan. Hot.
All right, Chad. I'm afraid to take John in Urbana, but I will anyway.
Yes.
John.
My favorite French movies, French Connection and French Connection 2.
Okay. Thanks for the call, John. I don't think French Connection is a great movie, Gene Hackman, of course. But I don't know if that technically
it's
can...
It's not technically a French film.
No, it's an American film.
Right.
But it has French in the title, close enough.
Coming up next, it's me, Mike Gallagher, right after Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
You know what? I had a feeling Babette's Feast was not a French movie. I was trying to remember. Babette, the character, is
French.
From Paris.
Okay.
But it's actually a Danish film. So technically, it does not qualify, even though it is one of the best movies ever made, Babette's Feast.
All right, check it out.
I still appreciate Ralph and Rantoul mentioning it.
Yes.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Michelle Leety is a comm staffer for the Virginia Parent Teacher Association in Fairfax, Virginia.
Oh, we haven't talked about them in a day.
She's also the first vice president of the local NAACP. At a recent rally in opposition to those who are in opposition to critical race theory indoctrination, she had... this to say to the rally goers.
So let's meet and remain steadfast in speaking truth, tearing down double standards, and refuting double talk. Let's not allow any double downing on lies. Let's prepare our children for a world they deserve. Let's deny this off-key band of people that are anti-education, anti-teacher, anti-equity, anti-history, anti-racial reckoning, anti-opportunities, anti-health people, anti-diversity, anti-platform, anti-science, anti-change agent, anti-social justice, anti-healthcare, anti-worker, anti-LGBTQ+, anti-children, anti-healthcare, anti-worker, anti-environment, anti-emissions policy change, anti-inclusion, anti-live and let live people. Let them die. Don't let these uncomfortable people... Uncomfortable people deter us from our bold march forward.
Yeah. Thank you. I think she was fine with all the antis, even when they became repetitive. It's when she said, let them die, referring to critical race theory opponents, that she got into a bit of a trouble. So she was ousted from her comms position with the Fairfax, Virginia Parent Teachers Association. No word on her status as a first vice president of the local NAACP. But it's an interesting one that Northern Virginia has become the sort of the the primary battleground for critical race theory, because enough parents have decided to stand up and oppose the sort of ignorance and intolerance and hatred that you heard expressed by Miss Leety. So it's interesting that it's happening there. It's also interesting because you have the proponents of critical race theory so demonstrable in their support. So it's really providing, I think, a nice lens for which the country to view this discussion, even when it descends into the silly, as it did there. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Peter Berkowitz, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, former director of policy planning at the U.S. State Department. Peter, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
So do you see what you're seeing in Northern Virginia over the last couple of months? Is that going to replicate itself around the country, or is there enough institutional inertia behind people like Michelle Leety that they will ultimately win the day and continue to lord over the institutions, at least in K through college education systems?
Well, there's certainly reason for intense concern, not only for Northern Virginia, but in schools throughout the country. I mean, it's a big mistake to think that the explosion of interest and controversy around critical theory somehow signifies that the issue is new. Actually, the transformation of the curricula for K through 12 schools in this country has been underway for years, even for decades. It's deeply rooted, and I'm actually delighted to see grassroots movements around the country that are trying to expose the way in which proponents of critical race theory seek to indoctrinate the nation's children.
But you say it's been around for decades?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, some of those who defend critical race theory say, well, this is an obscure academic discipline. It was invented by law professors 40 or 50 years ago. By the way, that part is true. It was an obscure doctrine invented by, let's say, law professors and some other academics, but it's been percolating through the system, down through the law schools, into undergraduate education, into our education schools, and that's been carried forward there into to our schools. Now, it's not always called critical race theory, but the idea that America's founding principles are somehow indissolubly bound up with racism, and that the core truth about the American experiment in liberty is racism, and that the country is in need of profound transformation. These are not ideas that have suddenly been introduced into curriculum last year. They have been in the curriculum for a long time.
Yeah, and so that one thing they say, on the one hand, they say it's this esoteric theory taught in a few law schools. It's not taught in K through 12. That's one of the arguments made, even while they're promoting it in middle school. And you've got the national or the AFT, American Federation of Teachers, that is, at their confab, promoting Ibram Kendi's new book and telling we're going to get it into every K through 12 system in America, or we're going to try. So that's the one argument is it's not really in K through 12. This is being invented by opponents of critical race theory because they're afraid of diversity. The other play is to say what was really afoot here is they're opposed to critical race theory because they don't want to teach the true history of America. So, for example, Jeffrey Dingler grew up in rural Alabama. He's got a piece, an op-ed over at Newsweek. I heard about the Ku Klux Klan for the first time when I was 14. The way I remember it, my eighth grade teacher informed us during an English class the KKK wasn't so bad at first. It started out as a vigilante force for defenseless Southerners who were being preyed upon by Yankees and free black Americans during Reconstruction. Of course, this isn't true. The Klan was always about racial oppression and white terrorism, but that's not how I learned about it in public school. And he goes on to say it wasn't the Civil War, it was the War of Northern Aggression, and we didn't learn enough about civil rights and so on and so forth. So bad was his K through 12 education that he's a graduate of Skidmore College. I wonder where he really learned his views about, you know, critical race theory, whether it was in K through 12 or at Skidmore. But that's the other argument they make is you're just afraid of teaching the truth about slavery, about Jim Crow, about the racist institutions and the oppression of blacks and others throughout American history.
Yes, well, I think that such statements render the actual history of the last 50 years in the United States totally unrecognizable. What are these people talking about? Since in the 1960s, in 1967, the biggest movie star in Hollywood was a man named Sidney Poitier, a black actor. He had won the Best Actor Award in 1964 for Lilies of the Field. In 1967, he was starring in three films, To Sir with Love, In the Heat of the Night, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. That's film and TV in the 70s. We had All in the Family, which gave rise to The Jeffersons, produced many other television shows that dealt with questions of race and justice. Daniel Patrick Moynihan in the mid-1960s, working in the Johnson administration, published what came to be known as the Moynihan Report, arguing that if we really want to achieve equality in this country, we have to go beyond civil rights legislation to address the breakdown of the black family in inner cities. And then since 1968, with Bakke versus Regents of University of California, Berkeley, we've been having a nationwide debate about affirmative action, not only in universities, but in government hiring and in private hiring. So, of course, people are going to be able to tell anecdotes about this classroom or that classroom, this teacher, that teacher, getting things wrong. But I've not seen really, the people who've been making this argument, I've not seen a quotation, citation of any critic of critical race theory who believes that the truth about race in America should not be taught. I think that's a total canard.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it seems to me that it also just runs afoul of what's actually happening in the classroom and has been for, I don't know, 50 years at least, probably longer than that. And interestingly, also in the classroom, you know, one of the standard texts to understanding American history is Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, which has been around for the last 40 years almost in classrooms throughout America. And, you know, that's a completely basically Marxist lens through which we understand American history, at least those who are using that as their textbook.
I think that's right. And if there's any striking deficit in American classrooms these days, it's in teaching students straightforwardly what are the principles on which this country is founded, what is the nature of the American form of constitutional government. And to tell you the truth, transmitting to students the accurate understanding that as far as large multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-confessional countries, the United States is the freest, most pluralist, and most tolerant that there's ever been.
So if this is going to be felled on the merits, if we're going to push back against critical race theory and this sort of indoctrination and neo-segregation that's being pushed on a de facto basis rather than a de jure one by these individuals who want to institute a new racial order, where is that going to come from? Because, I mean, for example, in the elite circles, this piece in the New York Post over the weekend, the New York City's top schools, this is a good example. The Ethical Cultural Fieldstone School, which is on the market for a ballet instructor, you know, like the ballet instructors you used to have in your school. But the ballet instructor must be, quote, committed to challenging Western dance forms and the hierarchical and pedagogical practices that often center whiteness in dance classrooms and on stages. And it's like that for every discipline at these elite schools. So it doesn't seem likely that it's going to come from a Grace Church school or Ethical Cultural Fieldstone school. So if it is going to come at all, where is it going to come from?
Well, I'm certainly not confident that it will come from administrators at these schools or from teachers at these schools. You can't expect it to come from the students. They're there to be educated, not to educate the administrators and teachers. My hope, therefore, is first with the parents. And indeed, what we are witnessing in the last year is the rise of one of the great grassroots movements of my lifetime. That is, parents rising up, addressing school boards, demanding that their children not be subject to indoctrination, but rather that in the classrooms facts be transmitted and that their sons and daughters be taught to think for themselves. So parents have to take action with their local school boards. There are steps for state legislators and federal legislators to take concerning federal legislators. It's one bill, I think it's being contemplated by Senator Cotton's office, which would deny federal funding to schools that promulgate critical race theory. State legislatures can are developing similar bills, but I should add one caveat. I myself am opposed to any language that speaks of banning critical race theory. It's much better for those who oppose the critical race theory to insist that our schools should not be used to espouse, advocate, demand assent to these doctrines. That's the real problem, not letting students know, at the proper age, of course, that there are people who assert that America's institutions are systematically racist. The problem is insisting that that this is the absolute truth about America, or demanding that students sort themselves into groups, and that some people, because of the color of their skin, deserve less, some people, because of the color of their skin, deserve more. That's odious, and that sort of indoctrination should be prohibited.
Yeah, so I'm in agreement with you, theoretically, but here's the real-world challenge, and I know you're going to see this coming. Look, I'm happy to take on Derek Bell and Ibram Kendi straight away, and that's how it should be. But the reality is, in these classrooms, Shelby Steele, Bob Woodson, Glenn Lowry, John McWhorter, those scholars and anybody who thinks like them are banned. So you're not going to get that arena where ideas are juxtaposed against one another and you hash it out intellectually. You're only going to get Kendi and D'Angelo and Derek Bell. So how does that operate in the real world if you have those in charge marginalizing any dissent or competing theories about societal organization?
It's a great question. And yes, I have partly anticipated it. It's just, from my point of view, it's too dangerous to be participating in censorship in a free country, but I'm not opposed to mandating. So I would be in favor of bills that find a way to mandate that the full range of views be presented to students. But of course, you have to learn to walk before you learn to run. I do not expect a third grade classroom to be a graduate seminar in which the full range of views about an American founding are presented. It seems to me only sensible to start with the straightforward view about the American founding, which emphasizes that the United States was the first country anywhere in human history to be based upon a universal principle said to apply to all human beings, namely freedom and equality. And eventually, as students learn that the United States did not honor that principle fully, the fight's over, and so on. But go back to your central point. I'm still opposed to banning, but I can. But I would back a bill that mandates, you know, with sanctions, mandates that a range of views be taught in class, because that fights the biggest problem. The biggest problem is indoctrination.
He is Peter Berkowitz, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, former director of policy planning at the State Department as well. Peter, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to the podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The Department of Justice Office of the Inspector General has issued another report on the FBI and a high-profile case. That would be the case of former USA Gymnastics team doctor Larry Nassar, who was convicted of sexually assaulting and abusing hundreds of young women during his time with US Gymnastics team.
Yeah, and big names, too. Simone Biles, among others.
Made into a movie. Sentenced to 300 years in prison. The DOJ Inspector General finding, I'm quoting here, Senior officials in the FBI Indianapolis field office failed to respond to allegations of sexual abuse of athletes by former physician Lawrence Gerard Nassar with the urgency that the allegations required. We also found that the FBI Indianapolis field office made fundamental errors when it did not respond to the allegations, failed to notify the appropriate field office, FBI field office, or state or local authorities of the allegations, and failed to take other steps to mitigate the ongoing threat posed by Nassar. For 6 weeks after the accusations began to pile up, the Indianapolis field office conducted what the report called, quote-unquote, limited follow-up, reviewing the thumb drive, calling one of the three athletes they knew had been assaulted, did not formally document any of its investigation, nor did it conduct further investigation. I mean, honestly, this FBI, no wonder it's taking so long to figure out whether Hunter Biden is in violation of simple tax laws with respect to his overseas largesse. This FBI, under Comey and Ray now, and perhaps going back further than that, I get the distinction that you're compelled to make between senior leadership and field agents, and I'm happy to make that distinction with respect to the majority of those who work for the FBI who are law and order types and are not political hacks. But a fish rots from the head down, and that seems to be what's happening with the FBI. Forget even the politics of it, just the competency level. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Adam Mill, an attorney specializing in labor and employment and public administration law. He's a contributor to The Federalist, American Greatness, and The Daily Caller as well. Adam, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Dan and Amy, thanks so much. It's so great to be with you again.
Well, I mean, you can't set it aside, but you just sort of include this Larry Nassar deal with the Russian collusion business and the spying and the general politicization of the office under Comey and to, I guess, continuing with Christopher Wray. And it's tough to have a lot of faith in what the FBI has to say these days.
Dan, I will see your Nassar scandal and I will raise you. There was just another OIG report back to June. It was totally overlooked, but it's really horrible. In February of 2021, the U.S. Department of Justice and the OIG and the state police in Louisiana received a complaint regarding an agent in Louisiana. And it turns out that this guy had been conducting multiple criminal acts, this FBI agent, as far back as 2016. And these are both adult and juvenile victims. So he had this crime spree of preying on vulnerable children and adults right there in Louisiana as an active duty agent. And the FBI, I either looked the other way or wasn't able to find a sexual predator within their own ranks as far back as 2016. So it really came as no surprise that this Larry Nassar thing is, reminds us of the same failure to act. And it kind of also reminds me that in some of the worst police states in the world, like Venezuela, Cuba, the crime rates are also very, very high. And it's because the police just don't seem to be very focused on actual crime. They're more about protecting the regime and keeping the regime in power, protecting their own power, enriching their people. I wrote an article about how the FBI has this kind of side hustle with this consulting firm called Tuva, and highly placed FBI agents retire. They can come back to work for this this contractor and then make these huge consulting fees. And the DOJ did another report on that and the fact that contract was not being properly supervised, that these payments were not properly accounted for, that they weren't doing performance reviews of the work, whatever work they actually did, which, I think if you read the report, it's pretty clear that on some of these task orders, on some of these payments, they can't actually show that any work was done at all.
Yeah, here's the thing. All these inspector general reports, I mean, they just become fodder for congressional hearings where and for a one-day news cycle, and then nobody's ever held to account for anything. And this is the fault of the Republicans too, you know, because everybody has to do like the perfunctory genuflecting before law enforcement and so on and so forth. That's fine. Oh, so stipulated. But now let's get to the focus here and let's get to some resolution. It's not just that. It's with January 6th too. We still have questions about exactly what the FBI was doing with January 6th. Did they have confidential informants? Did they have undercover FBI agents? What did they know? When did they know it? What did they communicate to local authorities? What did the sergeants at arms communicate to the leaders of the respective chambers? We have this smoking gun Lego set that was found at some guy's house that was charged in connection with 1-6. That turns out now that they're denying there was any essentially Lego set that was supposed to be some model of the Capitol. Yeah. I mean, what the hell with respect to this agency? And this comes out of the big bad era of J. Edgar Hoover, particularly at the end with the enemies list and so forth. And yet all of that Woodward and Bernstein era concern about big government and spying and law enforcement agencies that operate above the law, that's all by the boards now.
Yeah, and there was another article, Tucker Carlson highlighted this last Friday, that, I think just we've kind of passed this point where the FBI and a lot of these kind of administrative state powers are capable of being embarrassed. And, you know, in Tucker Carlson's piece, he talked about the Hunter laptop, the decision to not prosecute or investigate the Hunter Biden laptop scandal, which, it's just, he's got a lot going on there. You can set aside the fact that he probably violated federal weapons charges and the drugs and the prostitution. There's a real concern about the fact that he was essentially, brokering his father's influence by taking payments for these, dummy transactions. Before he was working in a consulting firm where he had no expertise. Now he's selling paintings. Have you heard about this?
Yeah.
He's selling paintings for $500,000.
Yeah.
Like one of his paintings is now more expensive than a Picasso painting.
And he has no training in art.
Well, I mean, he's a natural. He's got the eye and apparently the yeah. straw.
And
well.
A dad who's president.
Yeah, I mean, am I the only one who's noticed? Am I the only one who's noticed that he's bent over a table with a straw in his face while he's painting?
Yeah, I mean,
the irony is lost on him.
Yes.
Nothing
to see here.
Yeah. Apparently. It's true. But, but Hunter Biden, and how he compromised the administration and how he's just a general public embarrassment. That's one thing. But these institutions that exist from administration to administration, and they're either, furthering American principles with the way they conduct themselves, or they're undermining them. And I think your point, including your recent piece at amgreatness.com, is that they're undermining American principles. Forget their own legitimacy. By delegitimizing themselves, they're also undermining things like the rule of law and thus the American experiment.
Right. And the political's point, the article, the point I meant to make about the political article is that the political was congratulating the U.S. attorney for responding to a request from the Biden campaign to not prosecute. And they called it an example of sober prosecutorial judgment. But, I think the point here is that they've moved on from the point of thinking about the law as something that applies equally to both sides. And they don't feel embarrassed by saying, no, the law is a tool. It's a weapon and it's in our hands and we're going to use it and we're not going to put it away to be fair to the other side. And they just think that their ends are so important that the law has become just a means to do that. And they don't seem to understand that there's this whole other tier of America that looks on the way the law is being administered now, and they're thinking, well, that's not fair.
And if and when Republicans are ever put in charge of anything again, Congress and or the presidency, I mean, if there's, we give them one more chance and people are cynical about giving them one more chance. But what else can we do if they don't do something about NSA, about how the CIA operates and has operated during the Trump administration? And the same thing with Department of Justice and FBI. Then, you're just facilitating the unraveling of America, because if people don't have confidence in the rule of law, then, you know, you don't have a free society.
Yeah, but I am a little bit more optimistic than you are in one sense. And this is the point of the article I just wrote, which is, you know, conservatives are ticked off. They've been ticked off for a while. They've been screaming at the top of their lungs about how unfair everything is. But this is different. What's happening now is that people who are not political have been harmed by this kind of leftist movement, this total takeover. And, you know, you mentioned CRT, I think, earlier in your show. The fact that they're having to explain CRT, the fact that families are starting to flock to these school board meetings to demand that instead of schools teaching CRT, you know, teach racial blindness, teach equality before the law. But CRT doesn't advocate those things. And so parents are getting involved. They're getting involved in the school closures. Businesses are starting to fight back about these COVID restrictions. And a lot of people, I mean, there are a lot of corporations that have lost a lot of money because of all these restrictions. And I think that people are starting to realize that they can't just tune out and kind of, you know, put a sign in their front yard and forget about the politics, because it's starting to hit people where they live, people who are not conservatives.
Meanwhile, no lessons learned from Joe Obama terms one and two. We have the IRS and the press colluding again to target people for political reasons, with obviously the release of tax returns that were illegally obtained for the purposes of advancing raising taxes on the rich, quote unquote, just the same way people were targeted in Joe Obama terms one and two for their political and religious beliefs with respect to C3 designation. So, I mean, it's not like they're learning any lessons, and that must mean they don't feel chastened by the response to date.
No, they don't. And they don't even see it as like a bug in what they're doing. They just, they believe that their cause is so righteous that anything done to advance that cause, regardless of what rules have to be bent, broken, or, you know, taking advantage of the legal system in a way that, you know, they're not willing to live under the same rules that they're imposing. I think a good example is this thing with the Trump Organization being indicted for not paying taxes on these corporate perks. Now, I completely agree that these corporate officers should pay taxes on their perks where it's appropriate under the IRS guidelines. I just question whether this rule is being applied equally regardless
of
politics.
Of course. It's not even a question. I mean, that's a matter that's, you know, administratively settled with fines in 99.9% of cases. Yeah, I wonder why this is the exception. Adam Mill, attorney specializing in labor, employment, and public administration law, contributor to the Federalist, Am Greatness, and the Daily Caller as well. Adam, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a great week.
Thanks. You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560, The Answer.
All right, thanks for making us part of our morning. Dan, do you have anything to say in your last final moments here?
Rest in peace, Biz Markie. Biz Markie died at the age of 57 over the weekend. Yeah,
he died of with his wife, and I don't know, what did he die from?
And he died with that Mozart wig on, too, I think.
All right. Thanks to George Hoffman and Quinn McCarthy. It is now 9 a.m. WIND Chicago.